That hymn, in its original lyrics that Alexander Mack wrote, are drawn from this particular passage, maybe a passage that also occurs in the Gospel of Mark with a little bit more detail there, but this passage in several of the Gospels. Today, from Matthew chapter 16, verses 24 through 26. Then Jesus told his disciples, "If any want to become my followers, let them deny themselves and take up their cross and follow me. For those who want to save their life will lose it, and those who lose their life for my sake will find it. For what will it profit them if they gain the whole world, but forfeit their life? Or what will they give in return for their life?" When 1519, Hernan Cortes set sail for Mexico. And by the time he arrived at his destination, he had a problem. His crew was tired from the journey that had gotten them there and scared of the adventures that lie ahead of them. All they wanted to do was return home. That was a problem. History tells a couple of versions of the story of what happened next, or how Cortes solved the problem. Some versions of the story tell that he ordered that the ships be burnt. Other versions of the story tell that the ships be sunk. Either way, the way home was rendered impossible, and the journey had to proceed. That kind of thinking and that kind of story shows up a number of places if you listen and know what you're thinking about or what you're listening to when you hear the story. It was often told that in nonviolent training during the civil rights movement, those who were going on marches with Martin Luther King throughout the South were told, "We will respond to whatever comes without responding with violence. You will be attacked. You will be cursed at, spit upon, beaten, other forms of physical harm done to you. But you are not to respond in kind. If you think you can do that, not respond. If you think you cannot respond to the violence given to you, then fine, come with us. But if you don't think you can do that, if you think that if you are cursed, if you are hit, that you would want to respond in violence, then don't come. There might be other ways for you to be involved." Counting the cost, making a commitment to go forward along the way. It's a difficult thing to consider, or to put it in the words of the disciple Peter, in words that we've not come to but yet will in two chapters. "Lord, we have left behind everything to follow you." We have left behind everything to follow you. What it means to follow Jesus is one of the significant themes of Matthew's gospel. And one of the ways that we can measure this commitment is by paying attention to the crowds in the Gospel of Matthew. The Gospel of Matthew, as it turns out, is a very crowded place. There are 24 separate occasions where Matthew is telling a story and he references the crowds. In 23 of those cases, the crowds are present because of something Jesus is doing. The 24th time, there's a crowd of mourners that has gathered at a funeral, and the crowd gathers before Jesus arrives. But in the other 23 times, the crowd exists because Jesus is there and the people want to be near him or to receive what it is that he has for them. And so, some come because they want to hear Jesus preach and teach. Some come because they are hungry and want to be fed, or are hungry after they get there and desire to be fed. Others because they are sick or lame or demon-possessed. But all in all, there are people gathered around Jesus because they want what he has. And if we would measure the success of Jesus' ministry by this, it would look like this is a successful thing, because we all know that bigger is better, right? And the sign of any success is by how many people are participating. Well, maybe not so much, but But at the very least, there are people coming to hear what Jesus has to say. But the question leaves us with the question, have the crowds come because they are following Jesus? It is clear in the Gospel of Matthew that Jesus has a following, but does he have followers? We brethren like to describe our faith with the phrase following Jesus. It is one of the major ways that brethren for our 311 years of history have described this life that we share together, by following Jesus. It's how we talk about discipleship and the Christian life. And I like it. Of all of the ways that we might describe this life that we share together, of all of the ways that we might describe being a Christian, following Jesus works really, really well. One of the reasons I like this way of describing it is because it describes a faith that is active and visible. Following involves life choices. How am I choosing to spend my time? How am I choosing to invest in my relationships? And all it requires of us is that we stop going this way and start going this direction. That's all that is involved. And so following Jesus does not require that we know what we are doing. Now, that might come as a great relief. We don't have to be experts in this. All we have to do is be willing to walk down a certain road, to begin living life a certain way. There's no special status. There's no secret handshakes. There's no merit badges. You know, those are all great things in their place, I suppose. But with following Jesus, there is just a matter of starting to do it. We don't have to think that we know what we're doing. It reminds me a little bit of that old joke. Do you know what they call the person who graduates last in their class in medical school? Doctor, right? Don't push that analogy too far, but we don't have to be experts. And I hope that describing our life in Christ by the phrase following Jesus helps people who think that they have done something in their past that renders them forever outside the grace of God. I have met persons like that. There need be no barrier other than the ones we might impose upon ourselves in following Jesus. Just come. Just follow. But because we in the Church of the Brethren have typically defined church participation in this way, we do often reduce faith to the things that we do. And so we talk about these things with the kids and maybe with the adults all the time. We talk about helpful things like turning the other cheek and welcoming strangers, being kind to others, helping others in difficult needs. Most of what I put in the missions video this morning kind of fits in that category. Brethren have done some remarkable things in the world. Heifer Project. Don't ever let your United Methodist friends tell you that they started Heifer Project. They didn't. The Brethren did. And then we gave it to the wider church. Brethren Disaster Ministries, Disaster Response with Children's Disaster Service, Brethren Volunteer Service, Project Warm, Backpack Meals. We do these things because our heart has been shaped, because we understand that following Jesus involves reaching out and being connected to people, all kinds of people around us, as it should. As it should. But we ultimately are going to have to wrestle with what we do when following Jesus becomes difficult or impractical. When the way becomes hard, what then will we do? We can be tempted to decide to make a choice whether or not we think it will be effective in reaching a certain goal. For those of you who were here in Bible study Wednesday night, we looked at the Golden Rule. And we looked at, as we were studying that, we looked at a passage from Romans chapter 12, where Paul gives his church in Rome some helpful instructions for dealing with situations where people may be against you. And we asked the question, does doing the things that Jesus tells us to do, praying for our enemies, not repaying evil for evil. Does that mean that other people will stop being unkind to you? And we concluded that no, it does not. That this way of living our life of following Jesus might not achieve the ends that we hope it would. It might not make our lives any easier. But Jesus accounts for this when he's talking with the disciples and he says, you need to deny yourselves and follow me. Lay down those things of life that you find to be of the most important. Take up the cross. A lot of people, I didn't realize until someone taught me that the Christians did not use the cross as a symbol of art or jewelry for about 300 years because they understood it as an instrument of execution. We would never hang in a little miniature electric chair around a chain on our neck or a needle symbolizing a lethal injection because we know what those symbols represent. And for the early church, for Jesus' followers, he is telling them, pick up the instrument of execution and follow me. Because this might lead us there. And it's an interesting thought as we go back and remember all of those crowds that were gathered around Jesus in Matthew's gospel, all of the things that he tells us about. The last two of them. One, when Judas brought a crowd to arrest Jesus. And then the crowd that was gathered outside of Pilate's office when Jesus is condemned to death. The crowds may have followed Jesus. They may have been showing up all throughout Jesus' ministry. But in the end, as Matthew tells the story, only two women named Mary were with him at his death. The crowds were nowhere to be found by the time Jesus died. Jesus' mission on earth was to reconcile a broken world with our Father in heaven. And so we recall this from John's Gospel, John 3:16, probably the most famous verse in the entire Bible, that God so loved the world that he gave his one and only Son, that whoever would believe in him might not perish but have everlasting life. In Philippians 2, Paul writes to his church, in the church in Philippi, and he tells them, he incorporates a hymn into the letter. And he tells them about how Jesus did not consider equality with God as something to be grasped onto and held onto, but he gave that up so that he might be born as a slave and humbled himself to death on a cross so that he would be exalted and now serving at the right hand of our Father in heaven so that every tongue might confess that Jesus Christ is Lord. And we are invited to participate with Jesus in that mission. By following him. Jesus may have had a following, but he didn't have very many followers in the Gospel of Matthew. But what about in our day? Two of the many things that I appreciate about our congregation are the way that we work at issues of membership and discipleship. And the first thing that I'm thankful for in that is, if we're doing everything right, that the care that we give to one another is not a function of membership. If we are doing our job correctly, someone who is a member and someone who is not a member ought not notice a difference between the love that we share. And if you're finding that not to be the case, I want to know about it after church today. I don't think that would be the case, but there ought be no difference because the love that we share together is not a function of being a member of this congregation. It is a function of the hearts that we have, the affection that we have for one another. The only distinctions we make between members and non-members, by my reckoning, is serving in the top levels of leadership. So Sunday school teachers, church board members, and deacons. Those positions would be restricted to those who are members. But other than that, you can come be a part of council meeting, you can serve as an appointed member on a commission, come share your opinions, pray, discern right alongside with us. And I appreciate that about us. But becoming a member is a bit different, and it ought to be. Because church membership is not about a transaction of goods and services. So you'll notice this afternoon, or after church, during after church fellowship, there is no express lane at the snack table for members. And we don't give you a discount on the price for Wednesday night meals, whether, you know, it's $4 if you're a member, but $8 if you're not. I know that's kind of silly, but sometimes we slip into thinking about things like that if we're not careful, that, well, I'm a member, therefore. That's not how it works. Not how it ought to work. I remember one time I was in the airport in Chicago, and I'm sitting across from the gate where my flight was eventually going to depart from, and maybe that picture is good enough. They had those poles with the straps that you pull out to make aisles. And like in this picture, the aisle on the left were for Sky Miles or whatever membership, you know, United had for those who wanted to pay a little bit extra. And then on this line, it was for everybody else. And I should have taken a picture that day, because the only difference between the... Now, I understand that there is a difference, right? I mean, you get to go on the plane first, and it is nice to be able to put your bag in the overhead container and not in the seat front in front of you, at least if you're my height. It is nice to have that couple extra inches there. So I get it. But the only difference at the gate, that if you'd paid extra, is you got to walk through the line on the left, which had a nice little rug with the United logo on it, not totally unlike what we have out here we wipe our feet on. And the rest of us didn't get a nice little rug to walk on. And I thought, I have seen it all now. You know, right? This is the dumbest thing I've ever seen in my entire life. I mean, this is just silly. But it looked kind of, you know, just like that. Well, in one of the congregations that I've served as an adult, not this one, but another one, I got a call one day in the church office from an insurance agent, not Mary Wilson. They represented a company that gave a discount on health insurance to members of the Church of the Brethren. And they wanted to know if Mr. and Mrs. Smith, not their names, were members of this particular congregation. Well, I'd been there a couple of years. I didn't know Mr. and Mrs. Smith. But I looked them up. They were technically members. Hadn't been in the church for over 5 years. But they were members, and they got their discount. More power to them. Glad to. No problem. But I thought, membership is not a transaction of goods and services. It's not how this works. In fact, membership, I would argue, is not about the church. It's about you. And it's about me. And it's about the promises that we make when we stand in front of this body of believers and say, I want to follow Jesus. I commit to following Jesus with you. And I will live my life in certain ways because of the promises that I'm making on this day. So the love that we share with one another, that's about the church. But the commitment is about each one of us. And so on that day, when we make those promises, we're making a promise, first of all, to be a part of a worshiping community. Now, that means a little bit more than gathering regularly and singing hymns and praying and sharing our offering, although all of those things are included with that. Being part of a worshiping community means that I'm giving up my privilege of being the center of my own universe. That I'm attempting to say that Jesus Christ is the center. And I will shape my life around Him. And so we come and we lift our voices in song because we're singing our praises to God. And we pray because we believe God hears our prayers and answers them and hears them and replies appropriately. I'm not the center of my own universe. I don't get to say, well, I'm a member of this church, therefore. Or, if I don't get my way, I might respond in these other ways. All of that goes away, at least it ought to, when we say, I follow Jesus with you. Because we're part of a worshiping community where we've taken ourselves out of the center and put Jesus in the center. But then we follow that up because we're also part of an accountable community, which means if I ever say, or if you ever say, I didn't like such and such, therefore I'm going to not give anymore, or I'm not going to come anymore, then it immediately becomes not my job, but all of our responsibilities to say, hold on a second. We don't do that here. We don't reply that way. Because remember those promises we made? Come share your opinion. Tell us why you disagree. Disagree vigorously, if you wish. Sometimes I think, I'm going off the reservation here with this one maybe a little bit, but sometimes I think we act like it's a problem to be upset in the church. It's not. The problem often comes with what happens next. So if you're not happy with something, we need to talk about it. We can deal with it. But we don't stomp off mad. And just in case, what is Tim talking about? Nothing in particular. Just don't. Sometimes I know we do that too. Don't. This is general, stepping on toes, not particular. So because we're part of an accountable community, and if you want, by the way, public service announcement, if you want to know a little bit more about what this looks like, Sunday school for the next 6 weeks on Matthew 18 that I'm teaching back here in the classroom, we'll look at that in great detail. So we're part of an accountable community because, you know what, I get things wrong. It's 10 minutes to 12. They're still fairly young. Okay, there's still time for me to mess up a few things. You may already have a list. Okay, you know. And so guess what? You do too. So we help one another because we need the support and the wisdom and the insight. There's so much I don't know, and there's things that you don't know. And we work at this together. Finally, we're part of a witnessing community. I'm not so sure, but I think one of the best things that the church can offer the world is a way to disagree in a healthy way. Because we know how to disagree in unhealthy ways. That part of our witness says that our life together is not shaped by whether or not we agree on every particular detail, but on the love that we share for one another. That doesn't mean anything goes. But it does mean that our life together is strong and it is shaped by the commitments that we've made in Jesus Christ. Discipleship is our commitment to follow Jesus wherever he leads, to be willing to lose our life, knowing that it will ultimately result in gaining the only life that is worth having, life in the kingdom of heaven.